All right, our next guest is Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar. As I mentioned at the top, Ben is one of the best in the business covering ETFs. I would say he's certainly in the pantheon of ETF nerds. He produces some tremendous ETF research for Morningstar, and Ben is now on the line with us from Chicago. Ben, welcome back. Always great connecting.
Great to be back, Nate. Thanks for having me.
All right, Ben, so this should be a lot of fun. I definitely want to get your perspective on ETFs in 2019, and then I thought we might spend the majority of our time looking ahead to some of the broader, longer-term trends that could impact ETFs, even well beyond next year. But let's start with 2019. I know you recently wrote a piece where you listed your top 10 ETF and indexing stories this year. If you had to boil these down, what would be maybe your top two or three stories?
Yeah, I think one of the top stories of 2019 is that it was the year of zeros in ETFs. And in that respect, I would say that ETFs actually were playing a little bit of a game of catch-up with mutual funds. So in 2018, we saw the launch of the first zero-fee index mutual funds that had no minimum investment requirement, no commissions attached to them. So ETFs were kind of playing from behind as we headed into the new year. So we saw the launch of the first zero-fee ETFs. Later in the year, we've seen the zeroing out of commissions on ETFs. So what you're seeing from an investor's point of view is that the world is getting ever flatter, that the decisions between mutual funds, ETFs, all these things offering oftentimes like exposures really boils down to your unique preferences, your unique circumstances. This is something that I think all investors can celebrate, is that the very sort of last, at least explicit costs that you're paying to access the U.S. stock market, international stock markets, the bond markets, are really getting wrung out of the equation, which is a great thing for investors.
Ben, what do you make of those zero fee or even negative fee ETFs not really gathering a ton of assets? So it's interesting because if you look at the Fidelity zero fee index funds, those have billions of dollars in them now. And of course, Fidelity, I'm sure a lot of those assets have come directly from their platform. But do you make anything of the zero fee ETFs not really doing anything asset wise?
Well, what I think it shows is two things. First and foremost, it's that distribution matters. At the end of the day, I think distribution will ultimately rule the day. So to the extent that Fidelity has a very large captive consumer base in its brokerage, which is where those zero fee index mutual funds are available, that speaks to the benefit of having those clients' attention, having their assets on hand already. When you look at some of the upstarts within the ETF realm that have basically tried to give their stuff away, in at least one case, in the case of SoFi, effectively forced it down their end clients' throats and created some nasty tax consequences as a result, there are just certain things you can't give away. I was actually thinking of that this morning walking out of the train station, and there was a guy trying to sell my fellow commuters a Jay Cutler Chicago Bears jersey. There are just certain items that it really is no demand for, no matter how compelling that offer might be. He was asking $10 for the Cutler jersey, which is not where you're going to find a bid these days in Chicagoland.
Ben, in that piece you wrote, you had a stat that I found mind-boggling, even though I follow this stuff pretty closely. So you said at the beginning of this decade, index mutual funds and ETFs sold $1.6 trillion. That number, as of the end of November, was $8.2 trillion. Can you put some context around that? I mean, you've been in this business for a while now. Did you see that coming?
I don't think, honestly, Nate, anyone saw it coming. I think 10 years ago, everyone would have said, certainly the trend's going to be upward and to the right. I don't think there are many that would have said that ETFs and index mutual funds would have gone from a combined 20% share of the U.S. funds market to now just over 40%. That's truly staggering, and I think what that speaks to is a number of different factors. There's no one thing that's driven that growth upwards and to the right. I think it's a combination of changes in the economics of the advice space in particular, where you've seen massive outflows from legacy mutual fund share classes, load share classes that were kind of the standard fare for commission-based advisory models. As we've seen the move from transaction-led advice models to fee-based advice models, more and more of the cost of the asset management product is getting squeezed out of the equation. Oftentimes you would have a load, you'd have trailers along for the ride. That's getting wrung out. So, you know, you've continued to see, even in the case of mutual funds, inflows in many corners of the market, but that money's not going into your legacy ABC share classes. It's going into no-load funds that don't have all of those economics of advice and distribution that are embedded into those charges that are being borne by the end investors. So the changes in the economics of advice, I think, are a big piece of the equation here. I think the other piece is just growing fee consciousness, growing fee awareness on the part of the end investor that, you know, this is a value for money proposition in asset management products that is kind of topsy-turvy relative to what you tend to think of when you go out and buy most products, right? You go out and you pay for a Ferrari, you expect Ferrari-like performance. When you look at asset management products, more often than not, if you pay Ferrari prices, you're going to get Honda Civic-like horsepower.
Ben, before we move on here, anything else from 2019 that you want to highlight in the world of ETFs?
Well, I think the one story, and we'll see how this finishes out, there's still some time left as we head into year-end, that I think goes underappreciated is the fact that, at least as it stands today, fixed income ETFs have gathered more net new money than equity ETFs for the year to date. I think this is something that is evidence of the expansion of the ETF user base within the fixed income sphere, that you're seeing more and more traditional bond investors getting comfortable with an equity instrument, which I think it had been a real hurdle within fixed income ETFs in particular. I think fixed income ETFs are increasingly being looked to as a source of liquidity, a means of organizing liquidity in fixed income markets, which really speaks to the dynamism of the ETF wrapper. At the end of the day, all we're talking about is just a technology. It's an advancement in the way in which asset management strategies are packaged and distributed to the end investor, and the ETF wrapper in particular makes for a compelling proposition whether you're a buy and hold allocator or whether you're somebody that's looking to get into and out of certain corners of the fixed income market. So I think the growth we've seen in fixed income ETFs to date is exactly that.
No, I completely agree. You know, we crossed over $1 trillion in global bond ETF assets this year. I saw a projection from BlackRock, I believe, that they expect bond ETF assets to double to $2 trillion within 5 years, which I think seems reasonable. I think we'll continue to see this growth accelerate. I guess sort of on this note, as I mentioned earlier, I do want to focus more on longer-term ETF trends and predictions, things well beyond 2020. But I guess I did want to give you an opportunity to offer an ETF prediction or two for next year, since we did have ETF.com's Dave Notta give his earlier. Anything you feel particularly good about predicting for ETFs in 2020?
Well, I think it's difficult to predict anything. My crystal ball has never worked well. It's got
mine's broken
crack
as well.
In it, and a whole lot of super glue. But I think what you will see with certainty is a continuation of trends that have been in place now for quite some time. So the overwhelming majority of net new money is continuing to go into the very cheapest of the cheap funds, those that are offering the most broad-based, diversified exposures, those that are the most useful to the largest number of end investors. And those funds just so happen to be offered by the top, you know, 3 to 5 providers who continue to own and amass the lion's share of net new money. So the top 5 now account for 90% of the trillions of dollars in AUM that you've got in the category, and they continue to capture the lion's share of net new flows because people want cheap, they want broad diversification. They're moving further and further away from a focus on all things related to security selection. Portfolio construction's increasingly being automated. Costs are being wrung out, and people are realizing that, you know, much of the heavy lifting is done by the time you just build a low-cost, very sensible, very broadly diversified asset allocation. And from there, you can focus on the things that are really going to move the needle as it pertains to, first and foremost, staying invested, you know, tax planning, all of these other things that over a long period of time are going to be far more meaningful than, you know, whether you pick one value ETF over another.
Okay, so this is actually a perfect segue, I think, to look beyond 2020 and some of the trends that we may see in both ETFs and then I think indexing as a whole. And when you talk about the growth of passive, right now it's over 40% of all funds. Where does this end? In other words, how much more can passive realistically grow? Because I feel like we're already hearing a lot of squawking about indexing and ETFs being too big, right? That it's distorting markets or whatever. So how do you see that playing out longer term?
Well, I think inevitably it reaches an upper limit, right? It's only natural. Trees don't grow to the sky. Where that upper limit is really anybody's guess. In my mind, what I look to is sort of a gauge as to how far we could potentially go is really focusing on the amount of trading activity that's driven by index portfolios, because it's really at that point of contact, when buys and sells are being implemented, that's where there is an effect on market prices. And what you see today, based on any number of different estimates, is that your ETFs globally account for somewhere between 5 and 10% of overall trading activity. So I think we're a far ways off from any tail wagging dog type scenario. Could we reach that point? Absolutely. Am I concerned about that? Absolutely not, because markets correct themselves. They have self-healing mechanisms built in. Do we go through periods, that are uncomfortable and outright painful at certain points during those cycles? Absolutely. Might that happen? It absolutely could. But I have faith that the market will ultimately find that point. It has that self-healing mechanism, and there will be an equilibrium. The problem is, with any equilibrium, is it is a fleeting moment. We overshoot in either direction. I think we're a far ways off from overshooting in a potentially painful direction for markets and for investors as it pertains to where we stand with respect to the growth of indexing today.
Okay, what about fees? So as you were alluding to earlier, obviously a big driver of indexing's growth has been lower costs. And, it's remarkable. We're now at a point where an investor can put together a globally diversified portfolio for what, a few basis points, if not less. So I guess the question I have for you is the fee war over? Are we going to get paid to invest in 5 years? Like, where does this all end?
I think where it's headed directionally is towards a situation in which investors have to be sort of ever more diligent in terms of how the firms that they're choosing to partner with are monetizing them or generating revenues off of their hard-earned assets. So while zero commissions and zero fees or minuscule fees are certainly something to celebrate, it's important that I think investors remain on their toes, because what we're seeing is that costs are kind of creeping into the dark. They're going from being explicit and measurable to implicit and in some cases immeasurable. So there are other ways that different platforms, different fund sponsors might be earning money off of your hard-earned assets. Some of those are, in all cases, perfectly legal, perfectly above board, but I think there could be a greater degree of sort of transparency, of candor, and there always needs to be a alignment between the end investor and the product manufacturer. So it's important to keep an eye on things like opportunity costs. So, for example, am I earning a market yield on my cash balance? There are certain cases where you're foregoing many $4.95 commissions if you're earning 20 to 30 bips on your cash balance when you could be earning 2 full percentage points. So I think the fee wars is largely played out at this point. I think if anything, investors need to refocus on these other implicit costs. They need to refocus on the ins and outs of portfolio construction in particular, because 1 or 2 bips worth of savings on a fee is nothing if portfolio A has long-term returns of 12% and portfolio B has long-term returns of 10%. Investors should celebrate, but not, for a moment kind of, let down their guard, because ultimately all of these organizations aren't charities. They're going to look to earn their keep in one way or another.
Well, and to that point, I actually thought an ancillary benefit of the brokerage wars that we saw break out a couple of months ago when we had Schwab, Fidelity, TD, everybody else offering commission-free trading is, I think end investors said, okay, wait a minute, if I'm getting commission-free trading, how are these firms making money off me? Because I know they're not nonprofits. And so I think that did help shine a light on things like cash sweeps and other ways that these companies may be making money off investors. I just thought, to your point, there are some, we'll call them dimly lit areas where investors may not realize there are, you know, both implicit and explicit costs. But on the implicit side, I think the commission-free trading actually helped educate investors on some of these.
Well, and I think that's a great point, Nate, and something else, you know, I think that is in part driven what we've discussed before in terms of the growth of indexing is that there's so many cats that have been let out of the bag over the course of the past 10 years. Information spreads so quickly these days that, you know, when these things do pop up, it's amazing to me the speed at which it kind of makes it out there in the public domain, the speed at which people chime up or pipe up and say, hey, something's not right here. And it even, you know, in a matter of weeks in some cases, you know, creeps into these firms' marketing campaigns.
You're right.
So, there's no hiding anymore, which is, again, it's a great thing, I think, for the end investor.
Ben, going back to how you mentioned the largest fund companies are obviously vacuuming up assets, are you concerned at all about the top heaviness of the ETF industry with iShares, Vanguard, and State Street now comprising, I believe, over 80% market share? I guess if so, how do you see that evolving over the next decade or so?
You know, I'm not concerned with it. And it has to do, I think, chiefly with the fact that the competition to date has been nothing but healthy, nothing but beneficial amongst these top players for the end investor. I mean, this is what's squeezed fees. This is what's driven greater transparency. This is, you know, a large part of why we've arrived at the point we've arrived at today. And it's kind of the point now where, you know, access to public stock and bond markets it's become effectively like just a public utility. You switch on exposure to U.S. stocks or emerging market bonds the way you flip on a light switch in your home. You know, the expectation is that it's always there. It's always available to be flipped on and off. It's easy, and it's not all that costly. So I think the competition amongst the big three, the concentration of assets amongst the big three is not anything that I think investors should be concerned about, just given how healthy the competition among them has been, and I fully expect will continue to be for the foreseeable future.
What about from the ETF issuer side? So you and I haven't talked about this intellectual property debate before, where you have larger ETF issuers essentially copying the ideas of smaller ETF issuers and then offering those ideas or ETFs at a lower price point. Do you have any problems with that? Do you think it's a concern?
Yeah, I mean, what you see here, either with respect to concentration or, questions around intellectual property, it's no different than you see in any competitive, you know, capitalistic marketplace, right? Be it smartphones, be it, you know, soda, right? Like, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi can go toe-to-toe. They're, you know, vaguely similar, and it boils down ultimately at the end of the day to, you know, competition with respect to taste preferences, competition with respect to distribution, you name it. So I don't think the ETF industry is in any way unique. And then you look at the way that things have shaked out in terms of the composition of the market, the top heaviness of the market, then, you know, you see a power law sort of distribution no different than you see, you know, anywhere else in any competitive environment, nowhere else. No different than anything else you'd see in kind of nature more broadly. So I think this is perfectly healthy, again, to the extent that it's yielded pretty tremendous benefits to the end investor in no way distinct from, you know, what you would expect, just based on a look at virtually any other sort of competitive environment, in any other sphere.
Ben, going back to the bigger picture, as I look at ETFs longer term, and by the way, I don't know if you saw this projection from Bank of America that ETFs could grow to $50 trillion by 2030. You know, we just crossed over $4 trillion. Seems pretty aggressive. We can talk about that if you want. But when you look at the future growth of ETFs, I think we would both agree it's not going to slow. And I look at all of these false narratives around ETFs that are still out there, that they're distorting price discovery, that they'll cause a market crash, et cetera, et cetera. We could go on and on. And I think part of the problem, at least in my mind, is that the growth of ETFs has coincided with a historic bull market. And so I think some people have tried to put two and two together and somehow deduce that ETFs have caused the bull market or something, and therefore they'll cause a crash. I guess the question I have for you is, when we get that 30 or 40% down move, which is coming at some point, we know that, and when ETFs function exactly the way they're supposed to, when that drop does happen, do you think that will finally kill all of these false narratives once and for all?
I don't think these narratives will go away. I mean, it is, as long as there's kind of entrenched incumbents, you know, people who are just not going to, you know, move off of whatever their footing, whatever their priors might be, there's going to continue to be stone throwing. And it's funny because, you know, a lot of these same fears were fears that were raised about retail mutual funds when they first came into the market in the 1960s. You know, people were worried about the quote-unquote mutual fund situation, whereby, you know, newly minted investors amongst the retail crowd who were getting into markets for the first time via these relatively new, relatively more widely available vehicles were going to all flee for the exits, at the same time the next time the market turned south. So, you know, even though, you know, we're nearly three decades into the ETF experiment, there's still the new kid on the block. There's still any number of investors that just don't fundamentally understand, you know, what they are, how they work, and haven't taken the time to realize that really, if anything, you know, these could potentially help. They could have sort of a countervailing effect the next time the markets take a tumble. Certainly we saw that with certain fixed income ETFs and during the financial crisis, where they were really the only show in town, the only means of trading certain bonds in town. So, you know, there's always going to be kind of an entrenched incumbency that's going to keep throwing stones, you know, no matter how far the market falls, no matter how well ETFs perform, you know, through any market drawdown. I don't think that's going away anytime soon.
Any thoughts on that Bank of America projection that ETFs could grow to 30, or I'm sorry, 50 trillion by 2030?
They certainly could. It would be quite a feat. You look at the makeup of the global ETF market, and even though we've seen pretty tremendous flows into fixed income ETFs in recent years, it's still largely an equity story. So any of these projections ultimately boil down to being a stock market call. So embedded in that is some assumption about what global equity markets are going to do over the next decade. And if I had the slightest semblance of an idea as to, you know, how the ACWI was going to perform over the next 10 years, Nate, I would not be talking to you right now.
No, I completely agree. It's highly market dependent. Ben, before I let you go, as you look at the future of ETF growth, something that has been talked about more and more as a threat to ETFs is direct indexing. And I think you actually had one of the ETF memes of the year, where you had a picture from the old Coffee Talk skit from Saturday Night Live, and you captioned it with, "Direct indexing is neither direct nor indexing, discuss." So with the remaining time we have, how about you discuss this? What do you see as the future of direct indexing, and is it a threat to index ETFs and, I guess, mutual funds as well?
Yeah, so yeah, Mike Myers is Linda Richman. It's neither direct nor indexing. I think it's a really interesting solution that will meet the needs of a very specific clientele. I think it's got quite a bit of potential, in particular within the realm of ESG, where my ESG is not your ESG, is not Dave Natig's ESG, is not, you know, someone else's ESG. You know, where there is so much need for, you know, fine customization, and I think ESG is the poster child for this, I think it has in my opinion, the most potential. You know, ultimately, I think what you see with direct indexing is symptomatic of what you see more broadly across kind of the managed investments landscape, is that things are becoming increasingly splintered. They're being cut to fit the specific needs of specific clients in specific contexts. So, you know, one of the stories that I think goes underappreciated every time you see talk about massive outflows from mutual funds is that mutual funds have been losing share, you know, to collective investment trusts, you know, so kind of a completely different format and not a non-regulated format that's taken tremendous share in the 401k space because it's more cost efficient, it's a better option for the end investor. So, you know, I think to the extent that direct indexing is a better option for certain investors with certain needs, it's just, I think, again, symptomatic of, you know, prevailing trends in the space where there's no one-size-fits-all solution. I think, you know, ETFs offer a tremendous opportunity for mass customization, you know, to the masses that isn't as hyper-custom as direct indexing might be able to facilitate. I think the other thing, and we alluded to this before, is that there are certain sort of implicit costs or immeasurable costs that I don't think people have really wrapped their minds around as it pertains to direct indexing. You know, there's a lot of turnover that can happen within these portfolios, and, you know, that's something that, you know, ultimately comes out of investors' returns that they can't really fully wrap their hands around. And there was a great slide shared by Phil McIntosh from NASDAQ at a recent event in New York, where he showed that, you know, many times ETFs trade, you know, inside sort of the collective spread of all of the stocks that they own. So, you know, ETFs, not only from a headline perspective, are less costly, they're less costly than, you know, trading all of these individual securities a la carte. So once you kind of take that wrapper off and go into a direct indexing construct, you're going to absorb those costs maybe without even really knowing it. And the other thing, too, is that we talked about this before. How are my assets being monetized? To the extent that, you know, the firm that I'm working with can sell away order flow, they're going to make a lot more money if I own all 500 stocks in the S&P 500. Selling away all of that order flow that would result based on, you know, my unique needs, my customizations, than they would if I were simply to own IVV or VOO or SPY. So I think there's an opportunity for it, but I think it's ultimately going to be one, you know, it's going to benefit a niche audience.
Well, Ben, we're going to have to leave it there. Always enjoy connecting. Excellent stuff this week. Hope you and your family enjoy the holidays. And I'm guessing I'll see you down at Inside ETFs in late January.
There.
So certainly look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. Happy holidays.
That was Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar.